It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll meet the creator of one of the former President Obama's funniest speeches at the White House Correspondents' Dinner.
First, University of Wisconsin System President Ray Cross will propose merging UW colleges with four-year UW institutions as part of a broad restructuring of UW colleges and UW Extension announced yesterday.
Under the proposal, UW college campuses would be integrated into UW four-year institutions. For purposes of disclosure, UW Extension would be affected by the plan, and most WPR staff are part of UW Extension.
Hope Kerwin is a WPR news reporter based in La Crosse. She's covering the story. Hope, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what's the goal of this shakeup?
From talking with Ray Cross, from reading the press release, you know, it seems like the goal is to incorporate these two-year campuses, you know, under the umbrella of each of the four-year institutions, and you know, it seems like merge a lot of the administrative processes that, you know, each campus goes through in an effort to best utilize resources, is the way that it's been described.
And there's concern that enrollment at these two-year schools has been declining, right?
Yeah. So, you know, part of the press release came out with a bunch of data on enrollment since 2010, and pretty much every two-year campus has seen a decline in enrollment. Some of the biggest declines were at UW-Manitowoc with 52%, you know, negative growth in negative change in student numbers. So, you know, the argument that is being made is, you know, UW colleges is seeing, the two-year campuses are seeing less students, and so the goal of incorporating them into four-year colleges would be to best serve the students that they have.
And that's part of the argument UW System President Ray Cross is making in this statement. And he says, here's a listen, he says, demographic trends show this isn't going to change anytime soon.
And this restructure is not going to make families have more kids or somehow magically attract 18 to 25-year-olds to this state or older. This is an effort for us to more effectively concentrate our efforts to serve those that are here.
And Hope, that points toward a wider demographic concern they have. It's not just that enrollment is down, right, in these two-year colleges. It's that youth numbers are not increasing here in Wisconsin, especially compared to older demographic groups.
Right. He cited some data that, you know, when looking at population growth projections for 2040, you know, Wisconsin's population growth is mainly in 65 and older, whereas population growth among 18 to 64 year olds is less than 1% based on these calculations. So, you know, his argument is that we're seeing less students. We're probably not going to be seeing more students in the future. So this change is coming at a good time.
Hope Kerwin's a WPR reporter based in La Crosse. We're talking about a new suggested shakeup, really, in the UW system, merging two-year colleges with four-year institutions. And let's talk about that buddy system a little bit, Hope. How are they pairing up these two-year schools with the four-year schools?
So based on, you know, looking at a map, they pretty much tied the closest, you know, the two-year campuses to their closest four-year equivalent. You know, for example, UW-Fox Valley is a part of UW-Oshkosh. UW-Washington counties will be part of UW-Milwaukee. And so they'll basically be seen as a branch campus, a satellite campus of the four-year institution.
And are they selling this as kind of maybe a more seamless transition for maybe students who are local to that two-year institution? If they decide they want to go on to a four-year degree, they're sort of at that same school already under this plan?
Absolutely. In talking to UW System President Ray Cross, you know, he mentioned that their transfer numbers, transfers between the two-year campus to a four-year campus, he said, weren't as good as they should be. Those were his words. So I think that he's hoping that by connecting the two, that it will encourage more of the students to, you know, shoot for a four-year degree rather than just doing the two-year program.
Is there talk yet about possible staff or faculty cuts coming along with this proposal?
Well, Cross made it clear that there were no direct cuts, is he describing it? So no cuts were laid out as part of this plan. However, he mentioned that many of the two-year campuses are already undergoing staff and faculty cuts, adjusting programs based on seeing less students at their campuses. And so he described this change as a way to, best manage those cuts that are going on.
Here's the bit that affects us here at WPR. Again, full disclosure, we are part of UW Extension, and UW Extension would be split up into a couple different agencies kind of running the show. Is that right?
Yes. So they're planning to put a cooperative extension, which is, the extension offices in different communities, 4-H, those sorts of programs. That would be under UW-Madison, which Cross pointed out mirrors a lot of other extension programs in other states like Illinois. And then other divisions of extension would be placed under the UW System Administration. So, they're not getting rid of, per se, any departments, just kind of changing what umbrella they go under in the UW system.
This is still new. What kind of reaction did you run into as you were reporting on this?
Well, I talked to a campus administrator at UW-Manitowoc, and she said that she was actually excited about the change. She mentioned that they're already seeing some restructure at their campus over the last 2 years, and so she saw it as an opportunity to, continue serving those students in her area and potentially connecting them to other resources and programs.
I assume that Ray Cross, as system administrator here, doesn't get to do this all on his own. What are the next steps that would have to happen to make this actually happen?
This proposal will go before the Board of Regents in November, and next steps will be taken. If it's approved, it would be implemented in July 2018.
And are they making the case, Ray Cross and others, that we still definitely need these two-year institutions merged or otherwise? Are they talking about the role they play for students in the state?
Absolutely. Cross really presented this as a way that they are going to avoid closing any campuses. So, campuses that are maybe having financial struggles would avoid being closed by making them a part of a four-year institution. He talked about how important these campuses are to the local communities that they're in. And so they see this as kind of a problem solving to the situation that they're in.
Hope, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Hope Kerwin, reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio. She's based in La Crosse. She walked us through a proposal to restructure UW colleges and UW Extension.
Coming up, we'll talk to a speechwriter who helped the President of the United States find his funny. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later, a guest looks at discrimination based on height.
Right now, presidents have a lot on their plates. They have to craft domestic and foreign policy, broker deals, and reassure the nation after tragedies. One thing not in the official job description being funny. But even so, presidents are called on to be funny a couple few times a year. Things like the White House Correspondents' Dinner and the Gridiron Dinner are usual venues. So how does a serious president with a lot to do find the funny? They get some help.
Our next guest was a senior presidential speechwriter for former President Obama. He began contributing jokes to President Obama's speeches in 2009 and was the lead writer on 4 White House correspondent dinners. He's currently the lead writer at Funny or Die's office in Washington, D.C., and the author of the new book called Thanks, Obama, My Hopey, Changey White House Years. David, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
How did you end up as speechwriter for the president?
Well, I have to say, it was one of those things where I really fell into it. Most speechwriters I know didn't set out hoping to be speechwriters forever. Generally speaking, they tend to be curious people. All the speechwriters on the Obama team, I think it's fair to say, are the kind of people who would read the ingredients on the back of the cereal box just because it's written down. But I had fallen into this internship at a private sector speechwriting firm in Washington when I moved there after the Obama campaign. And Valerie Jarrett, who is President Obama's senior advisor, needed a speechwriter, and they had been looking, couldn't find anybody, and basically said, if you want, you could come work in the White House. You'd basically be the only applicant for this job. And I was like, yeah, twist my arm. I think I could do that. And that's how I ended up there.
And looking at the title of your book now, which spans your career over the course of your time working in the White House as a speechwriter, the title comes from something Vice Presidential candidate Sarah Palin said, my hopey changey years, I think that the quote was, how's that working out for you? And you kind of refer to her as a fairy godmother who hates you. How did this sentence and this concept get stuck in your head?
Well, she, as you said, used to kind of mock Obama supporters like me with that phrase. She'd say, you know, how's all that hopey-changey stuff working out for you? And I, in the book, write that while I didn't really appreciate the tone of that question, it's actually not a bad question to ask. I think it's, in a way, it's a very important question to go back and look at those 8 years and say, you know, those of us who worked for the president, whether you volunteered on one of his campaigns for a day or like me, you made it your full-time job, gave something of ourselves in order to believe. And we made ourselves vulnerable, and we had faith in this person and everything he could accomplish. And, you know, spoiler alert, I do conclude it was worth it, but I thought it was worth going back and really trying to think about what happened and how it felt and what it meant. And to me, that was an opportunity that you get from writing a book that other forms of communication don't offer as much. You can't be as thoughtful and reflective, and so I wanted to try to go back and do that.
And you write that hope and optimism were a part of what the appeal was for you about the Obama White House. What was it like to try to translate that into speech for the president, for the country?
One of the really nice things about writing for President Obama is that he had such a consistent vision all the way through his political career. So his convention speech in 2004 at the Democratic Convention when he was a state senator in many ways is echoed throughout speeches he did all the way through the end of his presidency. And that made working for him, in addition to the fact that he's just a great public speaker, it made working for him feel really meaningful because it didn't feel like we were trying to come up with who the president ought to be. We were trying to help a president who knew exactly who he was and what he stood for express himself to the public. And it was a real honor to be a small part of that.
And David, you write that in what you call Obama World, the then senator speech at Knox College is like Deep Space Nine. And in Obama's circle, people really geek out about it. What is it about that speech?
Well, I think that speech is pretty remarkable because, and this is the 2005 commencement address that President Obama gave at Knox College, and I think he laid out two things. One was this broad idea that that in America, your place in history is something each of us has to decide, and I think that was so inspiring because, I mean, I write about, you know, one of the sections of my book, the two sections, is titled Our Teensy Place in History. I did not participate in huge history-making events every day at the White House, but like everybody who works in a building like that, and frankly, like every citizen in a democracy, we do have an obligation to think about what our place in history is going to be and what our role is going to be in these much bigger causes and movements. And so that idea that everybody was being asked to be part of this big thing was so much of what made President Obama such an inspiring candidate, and then to me, a president. And the other thing he talked about in Knox College, at that speech, the 2005 speech, and it's worth going back and reading it or seeing it on YouTube, is he lays out this idea of a changing economy and how to make the economy work for everybody in the 21st century. And I think, you know, some of the ideas that he laid out and some of the principles he laid out, we were able to follow through on. But some of the challenges that we face, we're still facing and are real things that our country is going to need to deal with right now during the Trump presidency and also in whatever comes after it.
We're talking with David Litt right now. He's the author of the new book, Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years, a Speechwriter's Memoir. And David, I want to ask you about some specific interactions you had during your career. And you write about a breakthrough, kind of, that came with the president after some of the senior speechwriting staff had moved on and you got bumped up. And at a certain point, you're in the Oval Office and the president finally kind of acknowledges you directly, but he gets your name wrong. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah. So I was in 2013, I was a presidential speechwriter. I'd just been promoted from the campaign back to the White House. I went into the Oval Office with my boss, Cody, and my last name is Litt, L-I-T-T. And Cody, we were there to go over some jokes that I had written. And Cody very generously said, you know, Lit's pretty funny. And President Obama liked to banter. He liked small talk. But I could tell he wasn't quite sure he'd heard right. And he looked at me and said, yeah, Lips is pretty funny. And I just had this sort of moment because, you know, when the president gets your name wrong, first of all, I was a little excited because I was like, this is amazing. The president of the United States just referred to me by name. And it wasn't my name, but still, I, you know, we don't need to be nitpicky about it. And the other thing was, it wasn't like I was going to say, well, Mr. President, I know you're dealing with, you know, about 6 foreign policy crises and, you know, 5 domestic policy crises simultaneously right now, but can we really focus on the important thing, which is actually how my last name is pronounced? So I just said, all right, I guess I'm Lips now. And, you know, by the end of the spring, President Obama, I guess, had figured out what my name was for real. But it was one of those little moments that I wanted to write about, in part because, to me, this is a book about what it's like to be part of the White House but not part of the inner circle at the White House. And that was a perspective that I thought was probably underrepresented in White House books, and I was hoping I could contribute to.
Now, you didn't only write funny speeches for the president or serious speeches. You did a mix of them. But the funny stuff, it sticks out because you've been called the president's comic muse before. And this is something that was a niche for you. And I want to talk about some of the stuff that came up during the prep for some of these funnier speeches. There's a moment, a really absurd moment, I think, where you have to tell the president that you can't play, you can't run this funny slide that you put together of him because it's been pointed out that he kind of looks like Hitler in this slide, but no one wants to tell him he looks like Hitler. And it turns out the person who's going to tell him is going to be you.
Yeah, I was surprised by anybody. It was one of those moments when you think about making history when you walk through the White House gates for the first time, but you don't necessarily think the history I'm going to make is that I will be the first person to compare a president of the United States to Hitler to that president's face ever. That was not the kind of history I was planning on making. And it was true. We had photoshopped this slide and put the first lady's haircut at the time on the president's head. And I have no idea why, but at this specific angle, he looked uncannily like Adolf Hitler, to the point where we were just like, we cannot show this thing. People are going to clearly take it the wrong way. And one of the things I had learned at the White House is people are always looking for a chance to take things the wrong way, so you have to be careful about it. And I will say, I said, you know, Mr. President, we can't use that slide. You kind of look like Hitler in it, and had no idea what was going to happen next. And to his credit, I have never seen President Obama laugh as hard as he did in that moment. I mean, he kicked his feet up off the ground, you know, rolled back in the couch. He just thought it was really, I mean, he had a sense for just how absurd that moment was. And I think a different politician might have found themselves offended or felt that their ego was somehow threatened by hearing this from a staffer, even if it's about a joke. But I think one of the things I wanted to write about was these moments when you got to see, or when I got to see President Obama laugh and these kind of genuine moments, because I do think they were insights into parts of his personality that served him well as president.
Now, the White House correspondence dinners, and you were lead writer on 4 of them, those were a really big deal for you. And I want to talk about one of your signature achievements here, which was the Obama anger translator. Luther, I believe, was the name of the character. How did that idea get born?
Well, President Obama actually was always a fan of Keegan-Michael Key and Jordan Peele and their show on Comedy Central. And he really liked this Luther Obama's anger translator character. And for listeners who haven't seen it, Jordan Peele would play the president, very calm and collected. And then Keegan would say what the president was really thinking and sort of complain and yell about all the stuff Americans were putting him through. And we had always thought about bringing Keegan or trying to bring Keegan to the White House or to the White House Correspondents' Dinner to do this in person. And it just was never the right year. And finally, in 2015, we were looking for something special to do. We were kind of on a roll. And I thought, well, maybe let's see if he's available. And I had gotten his email at a holiday party. And it happened that he was. And so I think he was filming a movie, but, you know, got up on no sleep, had, like, filmed until, you know, 2 or 4 a.m., flew to Washington, and we did a quick sound check. And then we only had 30 minutes to rehearse that evening. And so one of the things I read about in the book was watching President Obama try to keep a straight face while Keegan was performing this skit with him. And he was not able to do it. I mean, every time Keegan opened his mouth, President Obama just lost it. And, you know, it's strange because I was watching the actual performance and thinking, oh, my gosh, there's no way President Obama is going to hold it together. And in the end, he was able to do it.
Here's a little bit.
It was he was able to do it, but it was, you know, it was touch and go for a minute.
Because despite our differences, we count on the press to shed light on the most important issues of the day.
And we can count on Fox News to terrify old white people with some nonsense. Sharia law is coming to Cleveland, run for the damn hills. Y'all's ridiculous.
I got a lot of views. How did you feel after that? I mean, it's a president up there with your writing and a very skilled actor as well, but did you feel like that was a win for you?
Well, I think, first of all, I should say, like everything we did with the comedy speeches, a lot of different people contributed to that script. So it was a win, I think, for the entire team who worked on it. But I also think it was something I was very proud of was that we were able to work a serious message about climate change into the end of the speech or into the end of the skit. And so it was less, you know, obviously it felt very, I'm personally very proud of having been a part of that. But more than that, I really feel proud that I got to be part of an administration that was thinking, okay, how do we use this funny moment that we know will go viral or that we hope will go viral to say something that matters? Kind of always thinking about where do we need to go as a country? And to some extent, I wrote the book. I mean, I wrote it before the election, but after the election, I felt like it became more important to really write about what it was like to be part of an administration that didn't just talk about public service, but really believed in public service.
And I want to ask you about that. President Trump opted to take a pass on the White House Correspondents' Dinner in April. Was that, do you think, a lost opportunity?
I don't think it was a lost opportunity because I think he is so bad at telling a joke in that context that he would have done something even more embarrassing than skipping the dinner. So it's a lost opportunity that he's not the kind of person who can make a joke at his own expense or demonstrate some humility. But I think that that's a much bigger problem than whether or not he attended one dinner. To me, the issue is that the White House Correspondents' Dinner, for all its ridiculousness, is a chance for the leader of the free world to acknowledge that they're just a person. And I think that's really important in a democracy, that they may consider their job, you know, larger than life, and they should, but they don't consider themselves sacred. That they're...
David, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, my pleasure.
That is David Litt, speechwriter for former President Obama, the author of the new book, Thanks, Obama, My Hopey Changey White House Years.
More coming up today on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Vera.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk to a Wisconsin emergency room doctor who says we should think of gun violence as a public health problem.
First, ask just about anybody if they'd like to be a little bit taller, and there's a good chance their answer will be yeah. For whatever the reason, tallness tends to be valued over shortness in our society, something shorter individuals know all too well. And while some may put up with gentle teasing over their height, there can be an ugly side to these attitudes and comments, too.
Our next guest says it's time to do away with the notion that taller is better and says that discrimination based on height is a common and accepted practice. In a new book, she talks about the factors behind height bias, how it affects individuals in the workplace and in social situations, and what needs to change on a legal and societal level.
Tanya Osensky joins us now. She's an Atlanta-based attorney, and she's the author of the new book, Shortchanged: Height Discrimination and Strategies for Social Change. Tanya, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me today. Appreciate it.
Well, Tanya, we've talked about a lot of different kinds of discrimination over the years on the show, gender, race, weight discrimination. Is height discrimination an issue that's not really on the radar for most people unless they've suffered on the wrong end of it themselves?
That's right. It's pretty much an unknown issue, or at least an unacknowledged issue in our society, but it's actually very widespread. It's very pervasive, and even though we kind of don't notice it, it's actually everywhere. It's in the media, it's in the culture, it's in our general attitudes, and it's in the workplace and in our schools, and affects people at all stages of their life.
Yeah, you write about examples, even in pop culture, where there can be humor based solely on someone's height, short jokes that it wouldn't have a place if they were other kinds of jokes, but for some reason that one thing is okay and taken for granted.
Exactly. I think that we are so accustomed to it that we don't even realize that what it really is making fun of somebody's genetic trait, a physical trait that they can't change. Not different, you know, than making fun of some other genetic trait that we would never normally do, at least not in polite society. But in movies and TV shows and commercials, it's very common to see short characters and short people depicted in a very negative way as comic relief or as even pathetic or otherwise, you know, negatively, like, you know, foolish. And it's very common. And it's actually very rare for short characters and people to be portrayed in a dignified or a powerful role. Most commonly, they're usually shown as the sidekick or the friend of the taller, you know, leading character.
And it's even gotten into the world of politics. You write in your book about questions raised about Hillary Clinton's height during the campaign. Now President Donald Trump talking about little Marco Rubio. And now this week, President Trump took to Twitter to call Republican Senator Bob Corker little Bob Corker with two D's. Apparently, Bob Corker is 5'7". There's been reporting that Corker's height is part of what ruled him out as a Secretary of State for President Trump. What's your reaction to this situation on height discrimination in the news this week?
Absolutely. It's systemic. And of course, Donald Trump mocks everyone in some way, and we are kind of accustomed to it. But it was systemic in the presidential elections last year. There were actually hundreds of articles published about height during the election season. Even in the most serious magazines and newspapers like Washington Post and Wall Street Journal, periodicals on both sides of the political spectrum posted articles about height, and no one even questions why it should be a topic worthy of coverage. But of course, you know, Donald Trump is accustomed to making fun of people for all types of reasons. And, you know, the difference in this particular case is that while everything else he says tends to generate a lot of negative reactions, even outrage from a lot of people, there's generally not much of a negative reaction when he calls Marco Rubio little Marco. Most people kind of jumped on the bandwagon with that and still call him that. And he's not even short. He's actually 5'10", which is exactly average height. But it's very common, and people kind of accept it as a normal and socially appropriate when they wouldn't otherwise do that for any other physical trait.
Talking to Tanya Osensky, author of the new book, Shortchanged: Height Discrimination and Strategies for Social Change. Tanya, I want to talk to you about how this plays off at different stages in people's lives. And let's start with kids. What kind of things do we see when it comes to bullying and other problems for kids who are shorter, either for a while or permanently in school?
Well, it's a great question, especially since October is Anti-Bullying Awareness Month and everybody's talking about bullying. And, you know, all kids expect to be teased and generally get teased for some reason or another while they're in school, and it's not uncommon. But research actually shows that short children, especially short boys, are physically bullied a lot more often than other kids. And anti-bullying materials typically don't even mention that. You know, anti-bullying materials often list all kinds of characteristics or attributes that make someone different, you know, race, culture, accent, weight, even hair color. But they never talk about height. And height is actually a huge factor in bullying because, you know, bullies will rarely go after somebody who's bigger than them. It's a lot easier to bully someone who is smaller. And another thing that's kind of unique for short children especially is that, you know, while we kind of expect teasing to come from other kids when we're kids, short kids are often teased by adults. a lot of times adults are the ones who say some of the most thoughtless and rude things to short children, and they will call them names like Squirt or Little Boy or Little Girl. They may not mean anything by it. They may not mean to hurt their feelings, but it hurts just the same. And kids remember those incidents even more acutely than they would, you know, bullying by other kids.
Yeah, and you write that this is something that doesn't end in childhood. People who are noticeably on the shorter than average side put up with maybe not maliciously intended comments, but that really can wear on a person over years and decades.
Exactly. It grates on you when it happens on a regular basis. And, you know, being put down doesn't feel great for anyone, but when it happens all your life and continues into your adulthood, when most other adults don't talk about, you know, someone who's overweight in a negative way and don't comment about other physical features, but as you become an adult, you still experience short jokes, and people still feel comfortable talking about your height, even in a professional setting. You know, I have been an attorney for 23 years, but I've had jobs where my manager made fun of my height in staff meetings in front of all his other staff and even in front of my subordinates. And, you know, that kind of made it very uncomfortable because it undermines my authority. It just belittles me in front of my coworkers. And I don't think that, you know, even though it's a joke and it's not meant to hurt anything, but it actually does. It hurt my standing in my department, you know.
And you write that as bad as that is, there are also financial impacts of being shorter than average long term in the workforce. Can you talk about how that plays out?
Very, very severely, and most people don't realize how big of an effect height has on employment opportunities. And actual research shows that short people are promoted less often to leadership and executive roles, and they also make less money than taller people. And labor data, reveals that short men make a lot less money than short and then taller men, and the same is true for women. The height premium for men is $2,000 per inch, and for women it's $1,000 per inch. So if you look at the term of a person's career, 30 years, 35 years, it'll add up to hundreds of thousands of dollars based on this, you know, supposedly irrelevant trait.
So this irrelevant trait is clearly relevant in our brains somehow. It's really embedded in, I guess, the way we look at each other, and you can't not notice height, I guess. How do we start, as you say in your book, in your title even, changing social change to start to change our minds and maybe overlook height differences?
Well, you know, that's right. I mean, it's kind of an unconscious thing. We all have this preference, this bias that kind of comes up naturally. But once we become aware of it, we can do things to stop the effects of it. So I think the first step we need to do is kind of raise awareness. And that's what I'm trying to do in my book. By writing this book, I'm trying to raise awareness. And it's important to change our own perception and recognize when we view somebody as inferior simply because of their height, and that's wrong, and we can stop ourselves from acting on it. But it's also important to raise awareness more broadly and talk about it the way we do about other forms of prejudice. You know, we think it's important to have a public debate about sexism and racism and homophobia and xenophobia and all these other forms of prejudice. So it's just as important to have a public discourse about heightism, because it's just as morally wrong as any other form of prejudice.
Tanya Osensky is with us. Her new book is called Shortchanged: Height Discrimination and Strategies for Social Change. We're talking about height discrimination and why shorter individuals are often disrespected on the basis of height. We're looking at what that means for them at school, in the workplace, at home, and in their daily lives.
And you can join us at 800-642-1234. If you're considered short, what has your experience been in both your personal and your professional life? Do you feel like you've been treated differently than your taller peers? Have you faced height discrimination? Where do you think the bias comes from? And what, in your mind, needs to change? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email us at ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're picking up our conversation now with Tanya Osensky. She's an Atlanta-based attorney and the author of the book Shortchanged, Height Discrimination and Strategies for Social Change.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you personally experienced height bias? Are you shorter than the average? How has that affected your life? Do you have to put up with jokes or remarks from people? Was it a problem as a kid at work? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. Dennis is with us in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. I had the opposite. Since high school, I was over 6 feet tall, and of course, I had trouble finding pants that were long enough. I was told I was expecting a flood because I had high water pants. Even as an adult, when I got in the Navy, I had to duck down or hit my head because the ships I was on wasn't made for me. There are buildings that aren't made for people over 6 feet tall. I have to duck down so I don't hit my head even now. Some vehicles aren't made for people who are over 6 feet tall either.
Dennis, thanks for the call. And Tanya, that reminds me, you write that there are serious safety issues because cars aren't designed well for people under a certain height, especially when it comes to airbags.
That's true, and the caller is right. Heightism can go both ways, and tall people experience issues as well. And of course, I can only write about my experience and my knowledge. And there are equally bad or serious issues that arise from product design issues that affect short people as well. For example, the airbags in cars. Airbags in cars were designed to protect an average male of 5'10", 165 pounds. And in fact, they are not safe for people who are under 5'4", which just happens to be half of all female drivers. And, you know, the car manufacturers warn you not to let children sit in the front seat because exploding airbags can be dangerous for smaller bodies. But, of course, short drivers must sit in the front seat, and they are not even mostly aware that this is a safety concern.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Rick in Oma. Rick, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Rick?
Well, I was going to say about short people. When I went to basic training on Lackland Air Force Base, out of a flight of 40 people, I was the shortest guy in the flight. And I guess short people can gain respect by thinking big. That's what I've always done. I figure I may be a small piece of leather, but I'm well stitched together. And I don't let size affect the way other people think about me. They, you know, they can think what they want. I really don't care. But as far as prejudice and safety issues for short people, well, I guess we're in not a one-size-fits-all world. So I guess what I was going to say is I just got to accept how tall you are and go with it, I guess.
Rick, thanks a lot for that call. And Tanya, you spent a lot of your book talking about the problems facing short people. You end with a lot of words for encouragement, as Rick did there. Can you share some of your thoughts?
I absolutely agree with Rick. I think that he's right, and we short people need to have a resilience and have a way to cope and deal with these issues. And we certainly, as parents, should teach our kids resilience too. And it's important for everyone, not just short people, but all people, to know and deal with life's issues. But, you know, that's all true, but it's not enough. I think that my point is that heightism is a real issue. It's a real serious issue, just like any form of discrimination. And, you know, it's one thing to work on yourself, to work on confidence and resilience skills and be a happy person, but it's also important to talk about this and work on changing that in society. And the two things are not mutually exclusive. We need to do both.
Rick, thanks for that call. We're talking to Tanya Osensky. Her new book is called Shortchanged, Height Discrimination and Strategies for Social Change. She's talking about discrimination, mocking, and real financial problems facing people who are shorter than average. You can join in if this is your experience. Love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Back to our callers. Geraldine is on the line in Menasha. Geraldine, hi.
Hi, talking about height, when I was young, 86 years ago, growing up, the ideal thing for a woman was to be 5'2". And as I grew, I got more and more comments, and I'd even have people in my family look up at me and say, when are you going to stop growing? And I grew to 5'10½", and I suffered all the way because I wasn't the norm.
Geraldine, thanks a lot for that call. And Tanya, this it does seem like an absurd notion, and it sounds like I may change over time, but the idea that there's an ideal height to be, even though it's a thing that we have really zero control over at all.
Right, it is, and it's a crazy idea that we put so much emphasis on something that really ought to be irrelevant, and I would wish for someday for it to actually be irrelevant. But the caller is absolutely right. It affects very tall women in a negative way, too. And short women who are, you know, shorter than 5'4", especially even shorter like me, 4'10" or under, experience discrimination too, and it may not be as severe as the discrimination experienced by short men, because sometimes short women prefer, you know, being treated as, you know, cute and motherly and nurturing. But if a short woman wants to be serious and professional and succeed in the corporate world, it's actually a huge negative to be short. And women in the corporate world, especially who have managed to achieve executive rank and leadership roles, tend to be extremely tall. My research found that the average female CEO, which there are not a lot of female CEOs, but their average is 5'9", which is above the 95th percentile for women. So it's exceedingly difficult for women who want to succeed in the professional sphere to achieve those kinds of roles if they're short.
Thanks a lot for that call. You know, another dark side to this story in some ways, you write about parents seeking growth hormone treatments, other treatments out there, proven or otherwise, if they're worried that their kids are going to be shorter than average, even if there's absolutely no health consequence to that at all. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, this is the thing that really got me all riled up to even write this book, because when I started finding out about how parents feel so much shame and guilt when their children are short, and that doctors accommodate that by putting short children on growth hormone therapy. Sometimes they start kids as young as 5 years old, and sometimes the therapy lasts well over 10 years. And it involves daily injections of growth hormone. And this is all, you know, for kids who there's actually no proof that they have a growth hormone deficiency. People do this just to try to counteract this this discrimination. And really what we have done here is we've started trying to medically change a genetic trait that society deems to be undesirable. And I don't think we would do that for any other genetic trait. And we would never do that to our kids, but we seem to find it acceptable to do that to short kids. And I do think that that's highly immoral, or at least unethical.
I want to bring on, I'm sorry, Tanya, I want to bring on one more caller before we're out of time. Nancy is with us in Milwaukee. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I just have a short comment. I am a senior citizen. I used to be 5 feet. Now I think I'm 4'11". Adults will still pick me up when they greet me.
What?
They will hug me and pick me up. It doesn't happen that often, but when it does, I know they mean well, so I don't want to say anything, but I'm not a child. When you meet a short adult, or, you know, even one you know, I don't care who they are, friend or relative, don't pick them up. Give them a nice hug, but don't pick them up.
Nancy, thank you. I'm sorry if that happens one time. It's too many. Tanya, how can somebody respond to that?
Yes, it happens to me too. So you're not alone. And I find it to be very disrespectful. And it's just that whole stereotype that short people are equated to children. You know, we are the size of children, so people assume that we are like children. And it's very disrespectful, and people feel comfortable violating our personal space. I have been patted on my head. For goodness sakes, please don't pick up short people and don't, like, use them as an armrest and things like that. It's very disrespectful.
Thanks, Nancy, again for that call. Sorry that happened to you. And Tanya, thank you very much for joining us today and sharing your book.
Thank you very much. My book is available on Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com, and I appreciate this opportunity to talk about it. Thank you.
That's Tanya Osensky. She's an Atlanta-based attorney. She's the author of the new book, Shortchanged: Height Discrimination and Strategies for Social Change. If you have a story of your own to share about height discrimination for shorter or taller than average people, there's still time for you to share your experiences and maybe your responses. Head on over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, or as always, you can tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Avocados are still hot in the news lately. We've talked about the avocado toast trend, also the damage done by avocado hand. That's when you try to slice the avocado and you end up getting your hand underneath. And it just keeps going with the avocado news.
Yeah, our own Chris Molina spotted yet another avocado story for us. A company in Spain apparently has released a new strain. The strain in Spain stays mainly on the plane. A new strain of avocado. They're calling it Avocado Light, with 30% less fat.
One extra bonus, I guess. Avocado Light is supposed to discolor slower than your average avocado.
Okay, that part I like, but...
But how did they achieve it?
Well, that and 30, like, less fat. What I hear about avocados, I'm not a nutritionist, but it's supposed to be, right, the good kind of fat in the avocado. That's
that
kind of fat you're supposed to be
eating. This is the kind of avocado of fat in your bloodstream that you want because it's helpful.
Okay, that's A. And two... Like, I think the fattiness of the avocado is what makes it so yummy and spreadable on that avocado, your daily avocado toast,
and
Veronica.
I'm thinking because I don't have daily avocado toast. And also, I was going to say, I'm always disappointed. Have you ever ordered guacamole or you look at the container and there's no avocados in it at all? I'm worried that these avocados would be like avocados without the avocado.
We will stick with full-fat avocados here on Central Time.